Welcome to Pzena Perspectives, brought to you by Pzena Investment Management, a global value manager known for our commitment to fundamental research and disciplined value investing. This podcast is presented by Pzena Investment Management, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor, and is intended for institutional investors only. The views expressed reflect the current views of Pzena as of the date hereof and are subject to change. There is no guarantee that any projection, forecast, or opinion in this material will be realized. Past performance is not indicative of future results. In the UK, this podcast is for professional clients only. This marketing communication is presented by Pzena Investment Management Limited, which is an appointed representative of Vittoria & Partners LLP. Vittoria & Partners LLP is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Welcome to Pzena Perspectives and the latest in our podcast series. In this episode, we're coming back to the topic of China. For those that don't know us, Pzena Investment Management is a global, deep value manager known for our commitment and dedication to disciplined classic value investing throughout an investment cycle. We're probably best known for the fact that's all we've done since the firm's formation back in 1995, and that we implement our process in a disciplined and systematic way. My name is Adrian Jackson, and I'm based in London looking after a number of our clients. I'm delighted to be joined today by Alison Fish and John Getz. Alison is the president of the firm and joined in 2001. Interestingly, she led the initial work on whether we should launch a discrete emerging market offering, which we ended up doing at the start of 2008. Alison's been a member of the emerging market portfolio management team since that time, and is also a co-PM on our international or non-US value strategies. John is one of our co-founders, a co-CIO, and a portfolio manager on global, Europe, international, and Japanese portfolios. Alison and John, welcome. Nice to see you both, and thanks for taking the time to do this. John, maybe we can start with you. You and Akhil did a podcast on China about 4 months ago. We're coming back to the topic again now. What's changed since that time?
Yeah, not a lot has changed, actually, Adrian. The reason we're doing an additional podcast is to dig further into some of the fears. I always like to say that you don't get significant undervaluation without real fears. So our clients have been asking us about the fears and the issues in investing in China. So we decided to come back and address some of those. Not much has changed. In fact, I just went over the first quarter, and clearly China again was the most disappointing region in the world from a performance standpoint.
So this is obviously a topic in our newsletter, hence the podcast. And Alison, before we get kind of into the nuts and bolts of the issues addressed in the newsletter, can you please lay out for our listeners the case for investing in China?
Well, Adrian, as you know, we're bottom-up investors. And so what that means is that we're not really making top-down calls. Therefore, it's hard for us to make the case for China. But, you know, the bottom line is that the companies within China have all gotten incredibly cheap. Over the last few years, the multiples on Chinese stocks have been cut in half, basically, since the end of 2020. And, you know, left and right, you're reading about investors calling China uninvestable. For us, you know, seeing multiples cut in half and entire swaths of our investment universe called uninvestable, that's the starting point, really, to do some deep fundamental research. And, you know, we'll be getting into those issues in just a few minutes. But, you know, before we do, I'd like to highlight, you know, right now, China is being treated as this sort of one monolith. But in reality, the opportunity set in Chinese stocks is far broader and far more diverse than in any other emerging market country. You know, there are more than 700 companies, Chinese companies, in MSCI EM index. It's a little over half of the index, if you count by companies, is just Chinese names. And that's nearly twice the next four biggest countries combined. And then when you look at sort of what's the diversity within that opportunity set of companies, what you see is that these companies cover more than 80% of the industry classifications in the index as well, which is nearly double the 44% that get covered by the average of the next four biggest countries. So you've got this opportunity set that's very, very broad and very, very deep. And then you look at the operating metrics of the companies in there, you know, within that first quintile of cheap companies. And what we see is that in terms of the historical operating metrics, they're more or less in line with what we see from other geographies across this cheapest part of the universe. But yet they're trading at a very significant discount because of the fear that we have right now around the macro.
Thanks. I think that's a great backdrop. But in fact, you can come out to the newsletter. There's some great charts in there that I'm looking at now that kind of bring that to life a bit. So, John, with that in mind, you know, the question I'm asking is, why are Chinese stocks so cheap today?
Yeah, we address four different reasons in the newsletter. And like you said, there's some really good data in that newsletter. You know, clearly, the one of them is the fact that post-COVID, there's a massive economic disappointment. Let's just say, you know, GDP has been slowing and people, you know, they talk about population peaking, et cetera. So one of the points is this macro fear about GDP slowdown. You know, first of all, let me just make a simple point. When people hate countries, statistically, historically, in valuation, when countries are out of favor, that's a better opportunity to buy the entire index in the country. Never mind the rifle shots that we're going to talk about later in terms of specific companies. But you know what we have found is that typically after periods of significant underperformance, you generally tee up better opportunities in any geography in history. But let's get back to the specific China fears. The first one is this massive GDP slowdown. A couple of things that are interesting there. When we say China slows down, we don't say it's gone negative in GDP. You know, we always talk about recessions and the impact recessions have on stocks and earnings, et cetera. And so what's interesting is GDP is still growing slower. So one point to really make is the fact that we're not even that confident that China growth is going to be slower than some other countries in emerging markets or the world for that matter. So I want to make that point. Second point, and this is really the more important point, is from a stock performance standpoint, GDP growth rates and stock performance isn't that correlated. We come up with a very low R squared if you look at just that simple idea that if a country is growing more slowly than it has historically, does that damage long-term performance? And obviously the reason it doesn't, the reason the correlation isn't high is because it's already reflected in the stock prices. In this case, it's really reflected. Allison just made the point, it's been cut in half over the last several years. So let's just get our math straight that the correlation is low. But GDP has slowed and that's creating opportunities in the China market.
Okay, good. Thanks for that. Allison, you and I both know it's all about the companies. Can you maybe come up with talk through quickly, please, one of the holdings in the portfolio that fits this theme?
Absolutely. I mean, as you mentioned, we're not thematic investors. It's really about the companies. But a company in the portfolio that perhaps is misunderstood partially for the reasons that John was just discussing is Weichai Power. This is the leading manufacturer of heavy truck engines in China. Clearly the market leader, they've got roughly a 30% market share, which is double the next biggest competitor. But what's happened over the last few years is volumes have really dropped precipitously for a few reasons. We had a demand pull forward on sales because of some new emission standards that were coming in. And then that got coupled with the zero COVID lockdowns, you know, which as we know, were very painful across the economy within China. But we believe that both of these are temporary issues. And in fact, you know, if you look at the numbers, things appear to have already inflected there. But, you know, people believe that it's tied to this sort of general slowdown in GDP, whereas actually the issue is around these two much more temporary issues.
Yeah, let me, Adrian, just throw in one point. You know, that's
sure
that comment that Allison's making is typically the things that hurt companies we look at are bigger than the GDP deltas, right? So let's say GDP falls by 3% in China. Weichai's sales fell way more than 3%. So Weichai's problems look bigger at the company level than the macro headwind. You know, one other thing in which I like to say about companies we're buying around the globe is that we like a company that's well-positioned versus competitors anywhere in the world. And one of the things we came across in Weichai is that if you look at it from a Asia standpoint, they're set up to be the low-cost manufacturer for these engines and can even export to other parts in Southeast Asia. So we're looking, let's just be clear, in this darkness, we're looking for winning companies, not companies that are poorly positioned for the longer term.
Sure. Okay. We talked about Chinese real estate in the last podcast with Akhil. Is that still an area of concern?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So let's just take what's scary in China. Real estate, you know, we talked about GDP and we can debate long-term GDP for China. And we think the productivity aspects can offset the declining population if there is a slow decline in population. But the bigger issues are certain things were way the heck above trend. Real estate was one of those. Affordability became a problem in China. There was too much speculation. We overbuilt, particularly in you know, tier three, tier four cities. And you've all seen the pictures of the vacant, you know, apartment buildings in China. So it does, it's going to take some serious time to work through this. So why would we bother investing now? What we'll say is two things in all this darkness. One is, what is the reason for the darkness? If you remember the GFC, caused, I like to say, by U.S. real estate problems and affected the rest of the world, the reality was we had very stretched homeowners. We had high loan to value, above 100% in many cases, and we had people that had no balance sheet buying multiple homes. You just have to watch some of the movies that came out, you know, after the GFC. And then we had the derivatives piled on top of that. Like, we created real nonsense before the GFC. The issues in China at the homeowner level are not that problematic. The Chinese homeowners have good balance sheets, et cetera. This is not a Chinese homeowner crisis. I just wanted to make that point, you know, difference. What happened was we overbuilt. Now, here's the thing about overbuilding. The reality is we are dealing with it already, right? Building has massively slowed down. Consumers are deleveraging. So we're in the moment where we're adjusting this. Home prices have come down a lot in China. The good news for an investment there, you know, is COLI, which we think is, you know, a big developer, but better positioned. They you know, obviously now much of their competition is going bankrupt. There's massive restructuring. So COLI as a land developer might actually benefit, and they are already benefiting because now the land price, the original investment they make to build, you know, housing capacity is now less expensive, and they have the balance sheet and lower cost of funding relative to competition. I like to make the example, Adrian, there. It's kind of like JP Morgan was a winner in the financial crisis, even though the financial crisis was a freaking disaster, you know, for most banks, you know, on both sides of the Atlantic. So we're trying to find the winners in this nightmare for the longer run.
Okay. So, Alison, John mentioned COLI just now. We touched on that a fair bit during the last podcast. Any holdings in the portfolio that you can think of with real estate exposure that we're talking about?
Yeah, actually, we have a number of companies that are affected by and related to what's going on in the real estate market with the slowdown in activity that we're seeing. One of which we added to the portfolio recently and actually owned historically, had bought pre-COVID and sold during the sort of boom that followed COVID, is Manwa, which is a manufacturer of recliner sofas. This is a great company. You know, they're one of the leaders in the world. They've got a 60% market share domestically within China. Also manufacture a lot of the sofas that you find other places like here in the US even. But in terms of the penetration of recliner sofas, it's relatively low in China and it's growing. So sort of regardless of what's happening in the furniture industry more broadly, you've got this penetration sort of market share gain story for the category. And that's providing some really favorable tailwinds. However, at the moment, You know, there are issues around volumes, both because of that pull forward of demand that happened during the COVID years, which we benefited from by being investors at the time that it happened, but also because of this sort of slowdown in general real estate activity. And then on top of that, you've got margin pressure due to temporarily elevated raw material prices that have yet to be pushed through in terms of end market prices on the sofas themselves. So it's creating another opportunity of a company that, again, you know, we once owned historically for us to have a chance to own it again in this moment.
That's interesting. Thank you for that. John, coming back to you, you know, something that's on a lot of people's mind, how business friendly is China and how does that impact your investment decisions?
Yeah, I think this is probably one of the more misunderstood issues out there. So let's just say if the second issue that's causing people to fear is that you can't do business in China, and business people in China are not aligned with business people elsewhere, that's just not true. We could say we're not aligned politically, but the reality is if you're Apple, you certainly want to work with Hanhai to continue to make your handsets that you ship all over the world. So the reality is we would say that maybe there's some deterioration in business opportunity, you know, cross border, I'll call it, because of trade restrictions, et cetera. I'll come back to that kind of that global geopolitical thing later, which is a maybe even scarier issue than this one. But we would say that the business opportunity is still there. And certainly I'll just, you know, we visit companies that we invest in. And I would say that the dialogue between us as Western investors and the Chinese companies is still very good. And you know, that there's nothing really going on that's changing as dramatically. And China still is immensely productive. You've probably all read about the fact that, you know, that Apple, we don't own Apple, but you know, it's so much in the press that Apple, here's a Magnificent Seven company that wants to diversify manufacturing. But we know for a fact it's tough because the productivity in Hanhai, which is actually Taiwan listed, but has most of its facilities in China, they can't get the productivity that they have at the Hanhai complexes outside of China. So it's a very, mm-hmm. I'll just say from a business standpoint, if it weren't for this geopolitical stuff, I'll come back to that later. But, you know, the reality is from a business standpoint, we would say it's game on still.
Thanks for that. Alison, you know, on that theme, any companies you can think of that we can talk about that kind of work on, are based on that fear?
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, the businesses that we speak to in China are still very commercially focused. But I would say the market has become much more aware over the last few years of the fact that they're operating within a geography where the government has become much less commercially focused. And that's really the fear that a lot of this is tapping into. And a number of our companies are affected by this sort of government regulatory overhang, fear of sort of waking up to a pronouncement that can be harmful to the business. And we've taken advantage of those moments as well in adding to our portfolio. And one stock that we added in light of such fears was Tencent. So Tencent, mm-hmm. Most of our listeners are familiar with this company. It's the largest internet company in China, incredibly strong franchises in gaming, advertising, and payments. And the opportunity where it got cheap enough for us, you know, cheapskates to buy a stake in this company was when it sold off because of concerns about steps the Chinese government was taking to curtail gaming, which was viewed as, you know, not particularly productive to those to the productive goals of the country and of the people, everyone sitting around playing video games. And so, you know, there have been periods, and this was one of them, where the government was slowing down the applications and approvals on new games, which is harmful to the business. And we were able to take advantage of that to buy this really fantastic franchise in the space.
Yeah, just jumping in on that, you know, it reminds me, you know, that sometimes we think of the government of China being really scary, you know, for investments, but sometimes even the interventions, some of us as parents or grandparents might look at it and say, hey, maybe limiting having an edict come out of Washington limiting the total number of hours for gaming for children. Wow, we wish our government could do that. So I just wanted to point out that we think of everything that comes out of Beijing as bad, and sometimes it hurts stocks. Like in this case, Tencent got very scary. But as long as that isn't like permanently impairing a company's ability to operate where they provide excellence in service, it's an interruption on a long-term journey. Tencent's an interesting question there.
Yeah, sorry. I just want to pick up on something that you said, because I think you really stated it so clearly and succinctly that it's really about, for us, finding where a company does exhibit that excellence and sort of what is the real value proposition of this business? Why should it exist? Why does it create value? And then if there's a sort of what we can assess as being a temporary interruption to that, then we've just got this opportunity to buy a great business on sale.
Yeah. To your point, we don't think global gaming is going away, right? I think that's the best way to put it.
Yeah, not if you ask my kids. That would be their
Okay. John, you mentioned a bit before now that there's kind of four concerns that are making kind of Chinese stocks so cheap. The first we covered was declining GDP. We then talked about real estate. And lastly, we just touched about this less business, or this perception of a less business-friendly environment. What's the fourth issue you're thinking of?
Yeah, well, I said it twice already. I think people are thinking we're going to wake up one morning and we're going to have a Russia event in China. You know, obviously the Russia event was Ukraine and all the carnage, right, of ownership and valuation destruction, right, of people owning stocks in Russia. Let me just make a couple of comments there. The destruction and impairment to owning Russia stocks. First of all, Russia was tiny. I like to say, weirdly, Russia is de-emerging from emerging markets. And when I was born, it was a superpower, right? So Russia is not anywhere close to the significance of China in the global economy, which Allison mentioned earlier, just in terms of even the share of the emerging markets index. So the reality here is China is hugely important to the global economy, but we're fearing that there can be an event when we wake up in the morning and get yesterday's news in China that we will find out that there's an invasion of Taiwan or some kind of massive geopolitical event that makes the trade wars that's already made some things tough look like nothing, right? That's the fear.
Yeah.
And you know, I think when we think about that as investors, first of all, Allison made the point, okay, there's 700 different stocks. Let's pick out the ones that have their own particular problems and aren't any more exposed to this than maybe less exposed, right, than some other holdings. I think people have not synthesized that if your worst fear is realized, that has an impact on the Magnificent Seven in a big way. You know, like this fear that we have on this, I'll call it mega geopolitical nightmare, will impact everything. It's hard for us to determine exactly which impact is bigger, which markets, et cetera, would be actually hard. But I wanted to say something else about the Chinese listings that are impacted by this mega geopolitical fear. It's now reflected in the stocks. Like, that's the most important thing. Everyone's talking about it. We have legislation in certain states in the United States. Parts of Europe are talking about it, where they say it's uninvestable. We're going to prohibit investment in Chinese stocks, et cetera. That's already happening, right, because of what's been going on. So I think the good news, I mean, this is going to sound a little perverse, but this is where we hang out. We hang out in fear. The reality, the perversity of it is now it's reflected. I'm going to make the point, it's always been there since 1949 when the KMT, Kuomintang, right, left China with many financial assets and set up in Taipei. Okay, from that moment, China's been saying reunification is a necessity. So let me just say that number again, 1949, no one on this call. Well, there might be a few 1949 births, but not many on this call. So what I'm saying is, during our entire investment lifetime, this has been an actual risk. We now have it embedded in the stocks. That's why I'm kind of excited about this opportunity in China, Adrian. Now, it doesn't mean we're going to bet the farm on China. And I hope Allison And when she gets excited about these stocks, we're not implying that we're betting the farm on. Does that make sense? Adrian, I mean, I just want to be really, really clear on this one, because we don't know what's going to happen in this last dimension geopolitical. It's just that now we think some of that's priced in. That gives us a real win opportunity.
All right. Thank you for that, John. I think before we wrap up, and I think we've kind of covered a lot of ground, Alison, any final thoughts that you can add, please?
Yeah, I mean, just picking up on what John was saying there, you know, absolutely, we don't know what's going to happen. And that's why, you know, even in talking about China and, you know, the fact that in emerging markets, it's a significant portion of our portfolio, and it's represented throughout our global portfolios as well. It's not to say that we know how things are going to evolve there, but the fact is that the issues that investors are afraid about involving China do not exist in a vacuum. You know, anything that happens geopolitically or involving trade, for example, will reverberate globally. But the risk of this possibility is priced into China and actually not priced in to many other places. I mean, just to use an example, for NVIDIA, you know, market darling, TSMC is the single largest supplier. And yet, you know, despite the fact that there's a discount on TSMC because of the geopolitical tensions between China and Taiwan, you don't really see any discount to that issue at NVIDIA. So, you know, for us, the bottom line is that we've chosen to add these Chinese domiciled stocks to our portfolios, knowing those portfolios are diversified, but despite this geopolitical risk. Now, the risk has always been there, but now it's really reflected in these share prices in a way that we haven't seen historically and that we don't see for companies that are domiciled in other geographies.
Alison's making the point very, you know, soundly and unemotionally. I just have to say, you know, in the early years of our emerging markets, when China was booming, we had, and some people might be on this call, so I apologize if I'm actually addressing you, beating on us for saying, why are you underweight China? Right. And we kept saying, oh, we're not trying to be underweight, there's too much excitement about the valuations in China. So if you look at our long history, you know, of investing in emerging markets, this is just a different part of a very long history, where now we're paying less than half of what we were for the same businesses when people were telling us we were underweight China. So I couldn't say that without passion.